Senator Kubley, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 2963 is a, it'd be a small bill in most years, I guess, but this year I'm not sure any bill asking for an appropriation is something. But, you know, I would ask the members to consider the fact that the demand for organic dairy products has been growing by leaps and bounds over the past several years. It's estimated that it's growing by 20% to 25% annually at the moment. And it really only represents about 5% of the milk that's produced in Minnesota that is produced in that way that comes under the national organic standard anyway. So I think it's not really known where the penetration for and demand for organic dairy products will go. But I think it's good to keep in mind that Minnesota now has about 100 dairy farms that that produce milk organically. And, you know, those producers are not going out of business. They're finding a market for a product that is marketed at something of a premium over milk that is not produced in the same way. But the number of dairy farmers that we have producing by traditional methods is still continuing, you know, its downward spiral. So it would seem to me that this bill might be helpful in moving the industry back in another direction. So, but with me today is one of those dairy farmers, Madam Chair, and I guess that I would like to turn it over to Loretta Joss and allow her to present a segment of the story that might be useful and interesting for you as committee members as well.
Ms. Joss, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senators, Loretta Joss from Gibbon, Minnesota. I am an Organic Valley dairy farmer and also work serve as the central leader for the Farm Ambassador Program for Organic Valley and am a Land Stewardship Project member as well. We've been farming on our family farm in Gibbon. It'll be 28 years in April. And I can only concur with what Senator Kubley has shared with you in terms of the tremendous growth we're seeing in organics and our inability as farmers to keep up with that. One of the interesting points I will add to what Senator Kubley shared with you is that the National Marketing Institute has now noted some changes in the demographics of the organic consumer, where they used to be highly educated, largely female, high income, usually parents of small children. We're now seeing that 30% of the frequent buyers are earning less than $15,000. So it's a testament to their commitment and the dedication to organics that we're seeing. Also, in terms of the farms, the Minnesota Department of Ag is indicating we have 560 organic farms in the state. And though our ranking nationwide has decreased somewhat, that's attributed largely to the fact that many of the pioneers in organics were here in Minnesota, and now other states are catching up. So the ranking, we're still growing at phenomenal rates, but our ranking is declining a little bit. As far as our farm, we moved back, my husband Martin and I moved back to the family farm in 1980, and brought along with that our backgrounds in wildlife biology, management, wildlife management, and environmental education. And those became the tools that led us into organic farming. But even with that heavy science background, without the lack of research and support there was back in the 80s, everything was trial and error, and a whole lot of error, I might add. That situation has changed dramatically for farmers today, but in light of the increasing demand that Senator Kubley referenced, and some challenges that you see as organic operations such as ours mature, the more questions you answer, for every one question you answer on our farm, it seems like 100 more pop up. We had a mystery in our field with a drought in 1988 when all the other neighboring fields were decimated by a grasshopper invasion, and ours was largely unscathed except for some damage around the outside edge. It was many years later that we came to find out it was because of our soil management and the higher sugar content in the plants on those healthy soils, that sugar turned to alcohol when the grasshoppers ingested it and they died. So there are mysteries like that going on all over our farm that we can't even perceive. So there's lots of research opportunities there for us yet. The challenges in meeting those, we certainly have to learn to manage our systems to keep up with this growing demand, constantly looking for new methods, new materials. Feed sourcing continues to be a problem as more farmers are coming on, and not all of them are blessed, as we usually are in our farm, to be able to provide all the feed we need. So you're scrambling to source feed, and it's very, very high cost. Adding on to the difficulties this year, even we had to scrounge to find feed to buy because the drought nearly wiped us out. We rely heavily on pasture all summer long, and that was only running for about 2 weeks this summer. So either drought and other organic farmers were struggling with the flooding issues, which has put increased pressure on the feed, plus competition for acreage from the corn production and ethanol. Genetics continues to be an issue with the forages. When plants that you raise in a grazing operation, and organics by nature is a grazing-based operation, you need different kinds of plants. So you're looking at genetics there and needing a lot of research there. In addition, your livestock, we've spent a lot of time breeding out the very natural systems that made ruminants, cows with four stomachs, function so well on grass. So now, as we're reverting back to some of those natural systems that make more sense, we're finding that the genetics simply aren't there for us. There's a lot of room for help there. Genetically modified organisms will continue to be a threat. And there's some interesting information coming out about how those will be affecting health, certainly of humans and animals, so lots of opportunity there as well. In terms of research needs, addressing all of these above challenges, and then also I think you'll find that being the small segment of agriculture we are, we're up against some pretty formidable competition with deep pockets who are kind of working on the other end of the segment from us. So in terms of meeting those demands with credible research and doing that from a regional-based focus, as far as I'm aware, we have established dairy programs in Chico State at California and the University of New Hampshire. Other fledgling organic programs, not necessarily dairy-based, are popping up in Wisconsin, Florida, Washington State, and let's see, others that escape me right now. But I'm skeptical whether those institutions can best meet the demands that, you know, the unique regional farm diversity that we're experiencing here in the Midwest. So with regard to Senator Kubley's bill, I totally support the investment in the Morris Dairy operation. They have an excellent start there in terms of their grazing system, working with housing issues, crossbreeding, nutrition and feeding strategies, all areas of study that will help address some of the challenges we outlined before. They're in a solid position with a minimal investment and some minimal changes in management to really certify that as an organic dairy research center and help Minnesota take the lead in the Midwest for that region. Also, from a meeting that I and several others had with Deans Levine and Durgan back on August 29th, it's become clear to me that much as the growth that we've seen in organics is a grassroots-based movement, it seems to me that so too will be the research. As an Organic Valley farmer, I know that the Chico State program actually got its start with Organic Valley farmers donating the animals for that program. I and 70% of the other 1,200 farmers at Organic Valley are donating a nickel out of every hundredweight of milk they produce for what's called the Farmers Advocating for Organics Fund. It's dealing with education, advocacy, and research. So they have just this year contributed $50,000 to explore a no-till management system at the Southwest Regional Outreach Center in Lamberton. So that money is coming directly from the ground up, from the consumers, the farmers, and the other stakeholders in the system. And I have to say, too, that the support that you have shown last year from this committee in terms of the $400,000 with the Ag Special is exactly the kind of partnership that's going to get the job done. So in conclusion, I will just say that We are entering a new era on our farm. Our son and his family have moved back as a fifth and sixth generation on our farm. And we're very excited to welcome them back, but wouldn't be so excited about that if we weren't confident that this could be a sustainable lifestyle, a sustainable, viable lifestyle option for them. So sincerely want to thank this committee for the attention that you've given these issues and the care you've shown in support of family farmers.
Hey, thank you very much, Ms. Joust. Are there any questions from members of the committee? Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know several organic dairy farmers. My brother-in-law is one of them. One of the things that the university has always been good at is the extension program where some of their professors were involved in extension would go out to the farms themselves. And sometimes I wonder if we are missing an opportunity to use a resource that is already available in working farms that would be open to allowing some of this research to occur right on location where the production is actually happening and the business actually has to occur. And I often wonder if we couldn't do a better job carrying that up instead of centralizing research in a location. And I know that sometimes that's best for best practices and sending out information. But we already do have some facilities, but they're privately owned. But if they could work more with the researchers and the people who are trying to develop the best practices, because I know a lot of these farmers have been doing a lot of this on their own. They've been trying to develop their own best practices because this is something that is relatively new to many of them. They didn't grow up farming like this. And I just, you know, like on your farm, would you be open to doing things like that and having it actually be the business where the production is occurring?
I'm a big supporter of on-farm research, and there's a great deal of that going on, and the university has helped with the Minnesota Institute for Sustainable Ag in coordinating and getting that research put together in the Green Book so it's available for other farmers. My fear in that is that for a lot of interests out there, if there isn't a big-name university attached to the research in a predominant way, maybe seems to have a little bit less credibility than it would if it's coming smack out of the main part of the university. I don't understand why that is, but it's a concern that I see with some of the research coming out.
Madam Chair, I would be suggesting the University of Minnesota Extension were doing this, taking it to the farm sites, just like they used to do more of. When I was growing up on a farm, the extension agent came to our house whenever my dad had some unusual insect that was, you know, infesting the fields, and would help identify that, or an unusual disease that might have struck a couple of the animals. I mean, the vet comes too, of course, but there, it's a lot of that seems to have disappeared, and we're centralizing the research and the concerns more and more. But then in centralizing it, sometimes I'm afraid it doesn't get back out to the producers. And well, I have concerns about that sometimes.
Madam Chair.
Senator Kubley, and then we need to move on.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Roebling, you know, while I would certainly agree with many of the things that you said, you'll recall that when you and I were growing up, there was an extension office in every county. That was before the so-called regionalization that took those extension offices out of every county and put them into a central location. It's now much more difficult for those extension agents to keep the kinds of tabs on research that's happening on the farm, like Dallas is talking about being willing to be a participant of. And so I think we have some real issues with that whole program that no longer locates those offices in a place where they make on-farm research as viable an option as it once was. But from my perspective, I guess one of the reasons for offering this bill is simply to, I don't think the state ought to be in the business of promoting one style of production over another. But we currently do not offer significant research in this area. And so, you know, I'm trying to balance that out a bit by saying that we ought to be doing research on every kind, every style of production, so that there's information available to a producer who wants to get started that they can match to their own ambitions, their own resources, whatever those might be. And I think, you know, this is one that needs some attention.
Okay, thank you very much, Senator Kubley. At this time, this bill is going to be laid over for possible inclusion and the recommendations to the bonding committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Ms. Hegard.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. My name is Susan Hegard. I'm the director of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education, and I'm happy to be here today. We're going to go through a number of slides with you regarding the governor's capital budget recommendations. On this first slide, you'll see the governor's recommendation in the context of the last 18 years. If enacted, this capital budget bill would be one of three nearly billion-dollar bonding bills in the last 4 years. The governor chose to go to the full cap of $965 million in his recommendation. Now, why were there three bills in 4 years? Some of you, of course, remember that in 2004 there was not a bonding bill, and that bill was subsequently passed in 2005. The fact remains that significant investments have been made in recent years to higher education. The second slide shows the governor's bonding proposal basically in terms of the various areas of funding. Higher education is number two on the priority list with about 23.24% roughly of the total. In typical years, the higher ed portion is about a third of the bonding bill, and so there's a departure in this particular bonding bill, and the governor, I think, was quite clear when he was doing his first press conference that because of some of the pressing transportation and transit needs, he felt that it was important to put some money towards that. Now, we know the transportation infrastructure is aging. There are a lot of needs there, and that the most recent bill that you all passed will probably impact what your ultimate bonding proposal looks like. The next slide shows bonding requests from the two public systems over the last 12 years, and we expect these requests to continue to increase. Building costs, materials, and labor have all increased over time. And these increases exceed the rate of inflation, if you look at this particular slide. So there's a trend upwards with some variation. On this slide, this is a summary of the state colleges and universities bonding history. And what we thought would be helpful is to show the last two bonding bills and how these requests compared to legislative action and then the actual bills enacted. So we did that for the last two cycles. In 2004, MNSCU requested $275 million, and the conference committee passed $213 million. That was about 77% of the initial request. In 2006, MNSCU requested $280 million, and the conference yielded $191 million. That's about 68% of their request that was funded. It's hard work, and in the end, as you see above here, there's never enough to fully fund all the requests. One thing I wanted to do, though, publicly is just commend MNSCU on their efforts in keeping tuition low. The governor's been very pleased with that, and we know that that's been very, very difficult for the board and for those at the system. So that's very, very good work. And then I think in their presentation, just tying their request to their strategic plan with student learning as the primary goal, they've done a very nice job there. The next slide is the University of Minnesota's bonding history. You can see there that in 2004, the university requested $160 million. The conference passed $142 million. That was 89% of their request. In 2006, the university requested $269 million, and the conference passed $158 million. That's about 59% of their request. This slide shows the governor versus Minsky and the U of M's bonding request, and there is a note at the bottom on their university's request for Bioscience Authority totaling $233 million. That's not part of the university's formal bonding request, but I do need to reference a letter that was distributed to leadership, and a copy was given to folks at the university before this hearing that talks about, it's from Tom Hansen, the Commissioner of Finance, requesting that the Bioscience Authority come under the overall bonding debt limit. And that's something that I can't specifically answer questions on this. I know that there's staff from the Department of Finance who have more knowledge and background, but I did at least want to point that out on this particular slide.
Madam Chair.
Senator Michelle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Excuse me, Ms. Hegar, but is that a letter you can share with the members of this committee?
My understanding is that the Department of Finance is here, and I think that they may have copies of the letter as well. I can't speak to them.
They don't have copies. I have a copy, and we can get copies.
I have a couple extra copies. I'd be happy to.
We'll get copies.
I have a copy.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
The Minsky recommendation is closer to the governor's 06 number than the 04 recommendation. This next slide just shows some of the goals that the governor was trying to follow in putting together his proposal. Follow campus priorities set by the governing boards wherever possible. I think one of the things that he really tried to do was respect the priority list submitted by the governing boards of the two institutions. You know, in some years there's a little skipping around, but this particular year, with I think one exception at Minsky and I think one at the U of M, the priority list was followed. To the extent possible, classrooms and science labs were funded, knowing that that's important. Maximum debt allowed, as I mentioned, debt service capacity, $965 million. And then, of course, there's always HEPR, and that's such a tough one because we want to try to fund repair and replacement. But as you can know, even in final bills, there's always a tension between funding new projects and HEPR. So there was some funding, of course, put towards repair and maintenance. More specifically, the governor's recommendation for Minsky, that's $129 million, but what I want to say is of that $129, $99.4 is state general fund paid debt service, and $29 million is Minsky's responsibility. So that number, if you're looking apples to apples, that number would be $30 million less would be the actual amount that is state general fund paid debt service. So if you look through the list, there's $40 million for the system-wide asset preservation, the HEPR, $25 million for Trafton. That's been a project in progress for some time. $15 million for Brown Hall up in St. Cloud, $14 for the technology labs in St. Paul, $9 million for StatGuest Science Building in Bemidji, $20 million for classroom renovations at various institutions, and $6 million to renovate some of their smaller lab sciences system-wide. The challenge, as I mentioned every year, is to strike a balance between HEPR and new projects. Minsky requested $347.4 million in total bonding for 2008 to fund 36 construction and design projects totaling $237.4 million. And they requested of that amount, $110 million for asset preservation. The next slide is the University of Minnesota's request. That's $129 million. In GO bond bonding for the U of M. It's consistent with the governor's 2006 recommendation of $127.6 million and well above his 2004 recommendation of $100.4. Just some details. The recommendation is $174 million compared against their $208 million request when their one-third user financing is added in.
Correct.
And the one-third doesn't apply to HEPR, only to projects. Let's see. With that, I'd be happy, Madam Chair, to respond to questions. I could go through the list in greater detail, but I think you've got it in the slides before you. And again, I can answer general questions about the bonding, the Bioscience Authority, but I think if there's specific questions, I would defer to the Department of Finance for those questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Ms. Hegard, in light of, you foreshadowed this issue already, but in light of the transportation bill's passage yesterday, do you know if the governor does intend to reformulate his bonding proposal to the legislature?
I Madam Chair and Senator Latz, I defer again to the Department of Finance, but my understanding is that with the forecast coming out on Thursday, there are going to be some changes, of course, to the bonding, his bonding proposal anyway, I think. I defer to Finance on that, but...
Madam Chair, Senator Latz, my name is Mike Roloffs. I'm working the Budget Division at the Department of Finance.
Could you speak into the microphone a little more, please?
Could you say your last name again?
Okay. It's Mike Roloffs.
Roloffs.
Right. Kind of like Jason Roloff, but not the same. Okay. There will be another, the governor will come out with recommended changes for his bonding bill because he did choose to go up to the maximum debt capacity based on the November forecast. The expectation is that the February forecast will have less, so that will change the maximum debt capacity, and he will have to change. Then there are other things going on, such as the transportation bill that was just changed that probably will reshuffle things a little bit with transportation. And so there will be, in essence, a supplemental capital budget.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Roloff, is the 965 3%, or is it what I've been hearing, 2.42%?
Mr. Roloff.
Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, the 3% limit is a fairly complicated one. Everybody kind of thinks that, well, next year that means we're at 3%. What it really is it's where the debt service streams projected for bonds that have already been sold, bonds that have been authorized and not sold, and possible bonds that would be authorized, where that finally hits 3% of the general unrestricted of the unrestricted general fund revenues. The 3% limit at that 965 is actually attained in like 2014, 2015, something like that. It also is based on the assumption that all even-numbered bonding bills, all big bonding bills, would then be at that same 965 level.
Senator Tomasoni.
Madam Chair, I realize that we've been doing bonding based on this 3% number for a lot of years, but aren't there four or five different ways to calculate our bonding capacity?
There are, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, there are a number of different limits that the department uses. The one that is referred to most often, because it is the one that puts the first one to create a limit for the bonding bill, is the 3% debt service limit. There's also a total debt relative to personal income, which is a 2.5% limit. And then there's also a limit relative to how quickly we pay off our debt.
Madam Chair,
Senator Tomasoni.
Have you done any calculations on those other two? Like, are they higher than 965? Or?
Mr. Roloff.
Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, when we do the maximum debt capacity forecast, we do calculate where we are relative to the debt as a percent of personal income calculation. We have not approached that 2.5% limit or gotten close to it, to my knowledge. We will do that again, and there are some discussions that, because general obligation debt falls under the 3% limit, but all debt falls under the 2.5% limit. The bonding that was called for in the transportation bill was just passed could have a significant impact on that 2.5% limit.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. We'd like to move on then to, just a minute, Senator Latz.
Mr. Roloff, were you going to, or was someone else going to flesh out this issue of the biosciences proposal falling underneath the 3%?
Madam Chair, Senator Latz, I don't have any real prepared remarks, but I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have about it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Latz.
Mr. Roloff, my understanding is that there was that the proposal was designed in such a way that the University of Minnesota would be picking up a substantial amount of the financial responsibility so that it would not be calculated as against the 3% figure. Can you tell me, do you disagree with that analysis? Do you think that's not an appropriate way to handle it, or does the governor disagree or feel it's not appropriate, or are there other reasons why you want to try to pull it back?
Senator Latz, are you asking about the bioscience proposal?
Yes.
We have that later on our agenda, so I'll let you, Mr. Roloff's answer, but then let's hold a more extensive discussion for when we have the bill before us.
Okay, Mr. Roloff. Chair, Senator Latz, you're partially correct in what you said there. The way that it's currently structured, it would, under historical scoring practices, it would not have been scored against the 3% limit. However, it is definitely a general obligation of the state in that there would be general fund, specific general fund appropriations to the university for the next 25 years that would cover the debt service relative to that debt. The U would actually sell the debt themselves, but the state would provide the appropriations to pay the debt service on that debt.
And I believe that it's a similar situation with the Gopher Stadium where the university is issuing the debt, but the state is paying the bonds. Are those payments also included in your calculation to the 3%?
Madam Chair, they are not.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Higard.
Thank you.
We might have you come back again, Mr. Roloff, so to elaborate on that answer I didn't let you complete. Minskew and this policy language proposed for the bonding bill, we'd like to just have hopefully a brief discussion on why you need each of these changes. Welcome, Mr. Johnson, and Senator Day.
For this.
Senator Day, are you under a timeline? Did you want to kind of say something about Owatonna and then leave, or are you going to just hang out with us?
Madam Chair, after listening to your cough, I'm thinking of some type of relief that I could help you with, but I don't know exactly where
anybody
I can run and get
really
that.
Anybody has a strong cough suppressant medicine in the room, I could really use it.
I'm chairing members and
4% limit. Solved it. A 4% limit.
I think
Al, you can.
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, for the record, Alan Johnson, Associate Vice Chancellor for Facilities at Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. And we have five particular policy issues that you had asked for us to address today. And because Senator Day here is with us, I thought we would talk about Owatonna first, if that's all right with you. So that's the... And if we could have a page to distribute some handouts on Owatonna, I would appreciate it.
Happen to our page. Oh, there he is.
Also with me here to my left is President Terry Leese from Riverland College, who is currently oversees the Owatonna College and University Center. So let me address the policy language in Minnesota State. In Minnesota Statutes 136F, it specifically names the cities and the town sites where colleges and university campuses are located. And that's always been taken by us to mean the properties, the land and the buildings that are owned by the state. A bonding project number 30 that you heard here several days ago, project number 30 in our priority list, proposes acquisition of the Owatonna College and University Center from the city of Owatonna. It was currently owned by the city of Owatonna. It was built specifically for higher ed program delivery, and it's leased to Riverland College. Riverland College has a long history of higher education in Owatonna, and if you support, or I should say hopefully when you support the acquisition of the Owatonna College and University Center in the bonding bill, it would require then a language change to designate the center as an official site. I'm going to ask President Terry Leese to say a few words, background about the center and what's been going on in Owatonna for these many years.
Welcome, President Leese.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the committee for this opportunity to speak on this project. Riverland Community College, as part of the Minnesota State Colleges and University system, has been serving the community of Owatonna and Steele County now since 1971. And we've done that through lease facilities throughout the community. It wasn't until 2001 that the city of Owatonna community leaders came together and floated some bonds and constructed the facility. And then my predecessor agreed to pay the lease on that facility. It's been a win-win for the college and for the community in terms of serving and providing access and opportunity to people that have historically been underserved. It's a growing community, approximately more than 25,000 population, and all the demographic projections are that there will be further growth. It's a very diversified economy. And so there is a need for post-secondary education at both the undergraduate and graduate levels to help this economy and the workforce development of that economy. There was a study in 2006 that was contracted by the system to study the educational needs in this area, and they did conclude that Owatonna was the largest community in the state of Minnesota that is not being served by a designated MNSCU facility. The challenge for Riverland, and I'm going to speak about Riverland, but then it's going to get a lot broader because this really is a system initiative, not just a Riverland initiative. The challenge for Riverland to date since 2001 has been that we pay approximately $260,000 a year in a lease. It is a triple net lease for those of you that understand that. Basically, it means that we pay the lease, we take care of all the maintenance and operating costs. If something breaks, we pay to repair it. And the challenge is that after the bonds are paid off, neither the state nor Riverland would own this facility under the present statute. So that's why we're asking that it be a designated facility. If it were approved for funding, it would reduce the cost of Riverland's share. If it's placed on Riverland's inventory, it would reduce the cost from $260,000 a year to $47,000 a year, which means that there would be more than $200,000 for services and programs that the community needs, and we're just not really equipped to be able to provide. The broader sense is that we are in partnership with other higher ed partners that you see listed in the brochure, and specifically what MNSCU would like to do as part of its access and opportunity outreach is to have Minnesota State College University Mankato, as well as South Central College, join with Riverland in providing lower division, upper division, and a graduate level education. There would still be a role possibly for private providers as well. For example, Crown College offers a baccalaureate degree in nursing that feeds from the associate degree in nursing that Riverland provides. So there's all sorts of opportunity to serve the needs of the community. It's just that right now I liken it to no good deed goes unpunished in terms of the cost of trying to pay off that lease, and that's draining resources that could be used to serve people.
Okay. Thank you very much. Are there any questions?
Madam.
Senator Coring.
Madam Chair, I just want to say that I'm on the bonding committee, and Senator Langseth's committee did visit this facility, and I got to tell you how impressed I was. And I, for one, you know, it's a long ways from my district, but I see the, when you were down in Senator Day's district. I got a little ahead of myself. I'm sorry about that. But I just think it's something that the committee should consider for possible inclusion into the bonding bill. So.
Thanks. Senator Day, did you want to say something?
Well, First off, Senator Coring, thank you, and to the members that are here, this would be a this is a wonderful project, but it's great for the state because the lease money is you know, kind of floating out there, and the community would really appreciate this being a designated site, and I can just tell you that there's our entire geographic area in southern Minnesota is hoping that this can be done.
Okay, any questions? Senator Sharon.
Just one quick question. Thank you, Chair. I'm noting in your handout about this that there is an additional 18 acres, a site plus an additional 18 acres, total value of $36 million. And I'm just curious to know what the thoughts are about that 18 acres and how then does that relate to a later discussion that we're going to have about another policy about the sale or disposition of land or improvements? And is that something that's been thought about in relationship to this extra land?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, to answer the second question, it has not been thought about in connection with this other policy. We thought about that additional city-owned land because the city was willing to sell that property along with the center. It is all one piece of property right on I-35. It was presented as made good economical sense to own that piece of property for either possibly future expansion or in land banking and simply having that piece of property owned by the state for some period of time.
Perhaps later when we talk about this policy, I can understand better that would it be Riverland that would be able to sell this land, should you choose? It's in a great location. The assets gathered from that, what happens with those assets? Perhaps later that can be a case study for the discussion of this policy.
Okay. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if Riverland takes, if Minsky takes over ownership of this facility and you continue, and Riverland is the main coordinator of it, and you're renting out space, how does that rent money for a building that would potentially be paid off, how would that be used within the system or for Riverland, or where would that lease money or sublease money go? You know, if you had Mankato there, or if you had St. Thomas or Crown College or something like that.
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, initially when the property would be acquired, there would be the one-third debt service would be a requirement in terms of costs to be covered. And Riverland would be assigned that one-sixth, half of that one-third. Riverland would have that debt service responsibility, would also have the responsibility of paying the lights and the heat and the custodial and repair and maintenance and so on. They would do a financial calculation then probably on a square foot basis or perhaps a program basis, and then have a use arrangement with whomever comes in and provides programs. So probably not a sublease, for example, to Mankato or to South Central, but rather on a yearly basis to say something like, well, you're going to have three classes two times a week and figure that out on a student square footage basis, and then there would be a use fee charge to the other institution that was using the space. Over time, that cost conceivably would come down as the debt service was paid off, but then there would be responsibilities for maintenance and repair that would grow. The fiscal agent, if you will still be Riverland College, and it'll be on their books, and they will be the ones managing the revenue and the expenses. It's very similar to other places where we have a host campus and other institutions come in and provide their programs on a host campus.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Coring.
Madam Chair and Mr. Johnson, does this mean this is just a question that I just popped into my head, does this mean that Owatonna College then would have a college president like Central Lakes College has President Lundblad, and, or how would that work then?
Madam Chair and Senator Coring, it would not have a separate president. President Lease as president of Riverland at the moment. Not that you're leaving. I don't have that message for you today.
Oh, good.
President Lease would be the president, just as he is of Riverland College and has Austin and Albert Lee campuses. It would add the third campus.
Okay, if there's no more questions on Owatonna, Senator St. John.
Just briefly, and I wasn't going to speak, but Owatonna is 40 miles west of where I live, and I will tell you it's one of those unique communities in south central Minnesota. It's here to stay. It's going to be here for a long time. It's got a rich history in terms of family corporations, whether it's Federated, Owatonna Tool, Jostens, Winger. That list goes on and on. I suspect to some great extent those people, Mayo's over there, frankly, in fairly large numbers now, and they're supportive of tuition reimbursement. And this community, I think, ought to move forward and have their building, and I hope we can do it for them. It's a great community, and I think there's a nice way to recognize that.
Madam Chair, do you want a motion or anything, or just going
to
possible?
I think we can listen to the rest of the policy language and make one motion on the whole policy language, or wait till the end of the meeting when we're going to do the letter.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, President Lee.
Madam Chair and members, thank you very much.
And Mr. Johnson, if you want to explain then the other policy language.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll go the first one then is the disposition of surplus property. Current statute allows the Board of Trustees to surplus state land and to sell that land in accordance with state procedures. The unique difference is that we are able to keep the proceeds of that sale and to improve campus location that had custody of that particular property. That's the way the statute is currently written. What we propose here is to add the word improvements to that statute, so to cover buildings that are built on that land. But also what we've learned here over the last several years is that there have been state buildings built that we are custodian over that is not on state land, that we actually ground lease land at least four locations where we have facilities. The example that comes to mind is the hangar at Winona, which is on an airport property, and we lease the land for that hangar. The hangar was built by the state several years ago. It's approaching 20 years ago now.
Mr. Johnson, the hangar would be considered an improvement?
Madam Chair, that is correct. Okay. An improvement to the real estate. And so, in fact, at Winona, Southeast Technical Campus of Minnesota State College, is in negotiations done with a local business who has a strong interest in this property. The college no longer has aviation programs, has no use for the particular facility, and is interested in selling that, using the proceeds to then improve their own campus at Winona.
Is that the circumstance that led you to bring this proposal?
That is
the
particular circumstance, yes, Madam Chair. And so that's the reason why we've suggested this change to this particular statute to allow these sorts of things to happen. This is the only site currently that we have any plans, that we've heard of any plans to dispose of something that's on a leased piece of property.
Any questions about this section? Well, Senator Sharon.
You're just changing so that if you build a building on somebody else's land, you'll be able to capture that if it's sold. But the overall policy is not changing. And that's what I'm sort of curious about, that how often does this happen, and what does it mean in terms of real dollars coming back to the campuses in a way that the state has already expended dollars to build something, and then that change occurs and it stays with that campus. You may not be able to answer that, but I would be curious at some time to know the history of what this actually means when it plays out.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, it doesn't happen often. because we don't have a lot of property that we're interested in selling, quite frankly. It does happen on occasion. We had an occasion in Hibbing with one of the old campuses, and the South Campus was sold several years ago. And there have been one or two, and I can get you a history on that. But so it does not change the basic policy of allowing us to sell property and keep the proceeds, and specifically to apply the proceeds to a capital project at that campus that had custodianship over the property.
Mr. Johnson, is there any incentive in this law for colleges to request to purchase maybe in the beginning of their project more land than they really need, knowing that at a later point, and the state pays for it, knowing at a later date they might want to sell some of it and recoup the profits for their campus? Is there any kind of perverse incentive there?
No, Madam Chair, I suppose there could be, but we haven't seen any of that. Can't think of any opportunity. In fact, it was just this notion that this additional land at Owatonna could be an opportunity, and it certainly could be, but we're not planning for that.
Okay. Any other questions? Then why don't you explain the next section?
The next section is to add a new subdivision to Chapter 16A. The history on this request is that the bonding
bill. Mr. Johnson, we have one above that. That's
Which one is that, Madam Chair?
For any project in excess of $50,000, changing that to $3 million, unless the Board of Trustees determines an emergency exists, you have to notify the Finance Committee of the Senate. This was something that was given to us by Binsky.
Correct.
Okay.
I just misplaced my notes, Madam Chair, that's all. There it is. Got it. This would be a change to the Chapter 136F64, which is our general construction authority. It is not a change to any of our construction policies or procedures or any of the processes that we go through. It is simply a proposed change in the notification process. Right now, 136F.581 allows colleges and universities to enter into construction contracts up to $250,000 without any board approval, without any restriction whatsoever. The 164F64 goes on to say that the board must notify the legislature of any project over $50,000 if funded by operating appropriation. So we have a little bit of confusion there. And then 136F64 goes on to say that we only have to notify the legislature if a project is over $3 million, if it's a revenue-funded project. And so we have these three different reporting levels. And so what we would propose here is to raise the notification level for all projects to $3 million for consistency of all capital projects, regardless of the funding source. Now, since virtually all our construction projects are either delegated out to our colleges and universities or they originate at the college and universities, this change would assist us in a uniform and a consistent way of contract management in our construction program. And so that's the proposal then is to raise the reporting limit, the notification limit to the legislature from $50 to $3 million across the board.
Okay. Any questions? Senator Roebling.
Well, Madam Chair, this kind of goes back to the question we had before about incentive if somebody were really thinking. But it's the whole policy. And, we see a lot of quotes come in for projects. And some of them, at least to my untrained eye, appear really high. And I think I wonder if any of these are padded for any reason. Certainly they don't want to have to come back and request more money for a project after it's started. But this provision allows the campuses to keep the excess money that the project wouldn't cost. That's my understanding. And I sometimes am concerned that those quotes that we see as we're looking at bonding proposals could be inflated, because if they don't spend it all, they still get to keep it for other purposes. And so I don't know how you do your quotes, but I worry that that could happen.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, well, let me address the reporting requirement and the $3 million level here. This would be for projects that originate at the campus. So the campus has the funding in their operating budget. They have received it through receipts, through revenue, through gifts or grants. Somehow it is at the campus level. So once again, going through a construction project and using a low bid, the low bid philosophy, which we do use, the low bid technique, you're assured the best way of getting a good price for what you want. And yes, if there were any savings below $3 million, they would stay at the campus because that's where the funding originated from. I think maybe you're thinking perhaps more of when we come in on a bonding project and ask for $10 million, and at the end of the day, there maybe only $9 million was expended. And another proposal we have here would be to convert that to HEPR dollars to be used at that campus. And I think perhaps you were thinking about that. I can only answer that by saying that by and large, we find our projects, first of all, using up all the funds that were provided, and in fact sometimes suffering losses in scope or in what they set out to get originally because of rising prices and other delays that they might encounter. So I don't think I've not seen a case where we have a windfall, I guess, is maybe one way to look at it, where we have a windfall of funds available at the end of a project that is suddenly available to spend on something else. And, in fact, if it is a particular bonding project, it is limited. You can't take – if you had $1 million savings on a particular bonding project for a science building, you couldn't take those savings and turn it over and build a sports stadium with it. It's very specific. You have to use it in that project. So if I had $1 million left over in a science building project, I would be looking to spend that money either in the science building or converting it to HEPR for use at that particular campus for some HEPR-related project.
And I was speaking of the bonding proposals and not the money not the projects where the money is raised by the campus, because certainly that has every right to stay on that campus if they're the ones that are financing it themselves. But I was questioning how the money can be rolled into HEPR projects for that campus. And, you know, I doubt that it happens very frequently that you'd come in way under bid or way under projections, that the bids come in under. But there could be an incentive for some campuses that need HEPR projects to do something like that.
So we're talking about the third item?
We were on the construction authority notification level. We're still on that one. Yes, ma'am.
I thought Senator Roebling's comments, though, were on the HEPR provision.
That's
the unspent portion.
Right. Madam Chair, that's what I...
Yes.
We spilled into that.
We spilled into that. That's what I thought. Did you want to say anything more about that, Mr. Johnson?
On the notification?
Or either one.
Well, I'm complete on the notification one. Okay. On the HEPR request, that has been part of bonding bills for the last three cycles, I think, perhaps four, where the unspent capital project appropriation could be converted to HEPR. And you were right, Senator Roebling, about it. It doesn't happen frequently. We've used it three times to the tune of about $1 million, $1.1 million in the last 4 or 5 years. So it doesn't happen frequently. There really isn't any incentive for a school to pad their estimate in order to get more cheaper dollars, because I like to think we're fairly rigid in looking at the capital proposal as it comes in the door to be able to be sure that there's enough money in the capital project proposal to do the job that's desired, but yet not too much money, because after all, if College A gets $1 million too much and pads their construction estimate, College B suffers that $1 million somewhere. Mm-hmm. So we have to be pretty careful around the house.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the final item on revenue bonds.
The final item, Madam Chair, is to amend the revenue fund bond capacity. And the authority to sell revenue bonds is very limited within Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. It's the only bonds that we can sell ourselves that the authority is founded in statute, and it's only at the 7 state universities, and it's only for certain revenue-producing buildings at the universities, residence halls, student unions, parking ramps, and lately we've had a couple of wellness facilities that have fallen under this criteria. The revenue fund has had the authority to sell bonds since 1955. Prior to 1998, the debt authority in statute was $40 million. In 2000, about the time we were getting more and more familiar with the condition of our campuses and condition assessment and backlog and so on, we also were looking at revenue fund facilities and discovered that there was a growing backlog in our residence halls and student unions. And so in 2000, we asked that the authority be raised to $100 million, and that took place back in 2000. Actually, we had asked for the authority to be raised $135 million, and the legislature raised it to $100 million. Later on in 2006, we asked again for an increase in authority, and that was raised to $150 million. So the current debt limit for the revenue fund in statute is $150 million. Now, our actual debt of the revenue fund at the moment is about $120 million. So we've got $30 million float in debt authority. The revenue fund has had several very notable projects recently that have been funded by bond proceeds. Many of these you've seen as you've traveled around the state, dining service improvements at Moorhead, student union addition and improvements at Mankato, Lawrence Hall renovation at St. Cloud, construction of the new residence hall at Mankato. The Julius Sears Residence Hall is our largest project that's going on right now. Currently, we have plans for a bond sale in June of 2008 for two Winona State projects, $7 million for Memorial Hall, which is number 20 on our bonding request. It'll share GO proceeds with revenue fund with private donations. And Winona is also designing a $43 million new residence hall. So about about a $50 million bond sale coming up here this June. And in order to finance these projects, we have to raise the debt limit above $150 million. Now, the legislature is notified each time we sell bonds. Just for your information, these revenue bonds are very highly rated. Moody's rating last time was AA3, and Standard & Poor's was AA, just a tick lower than the state's rating of AA1 for Moody's and AAA for S&P. We also have about $100 million in new projects that are very early in the planning phases for 2009 and 10, things like another renovation in Bemidji in a res hall, perhaps a parking ramp at Metro State, another housing development at Mankato, St. Cloud housing, and so on. So we've asked to raise the limit to $250 million to cover these current needs and to cover some near-term needs that we see coming up. Now, state university student government is consulted before any of these bond-funded projects are submitted to our Board of Trustees. The board wants to hear from students before they authorize the sale. You heard last week when we presented this the first time that the Student Association supported the increase in the debt cap. And just as another note, this is not state debt. The debt here is secured solely by the revenue and the financial assets of the revenue fund, of the State University Revenue Fund. And with that, that completes my overview of this item and all five policy issues.
Great. Any questions? Senator Sharon.
I'm glad you spoke to the students. I was going to ask about that, but my second question was, if there is one of these projects that the revenue from the project itself, like the students' dorm charges or parking fees or whatever, is each project's bonding paid for within that particular university's fee structure? So if you build a parking ramp at Minnesota State University Mankato, are the parking fees there, the revenue adequate to support that particular project? So that when we increase this to 250, it means that each project has the capacity within that campus where that development is occurring to meet the obligation, the revenue obligation.
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, the answer is yes. We look at the project as proposed. Will the project itself, cash flow itself, and will the revenue meet the debt requirements and the operating requirements for the specific project, say a residence hall? But we can also look at it in context with the other residence halls and the residential life program at that university. And so sometimes we might give a break to a particular project to get it started, knowing that 4 or 5 years from now we may take down a residence hall and it may move the revenue into the new one. We don't look at it across from one university to another. Now, if you were a bondholder and you looked at these bonds, you would only see Minsku revenue bonds, and the ratings are based on the health of not only the revenue fund, but the financial health of the whole system. So looking in, it's one fund, but each university is responsible for managing and running their own. It's in each university's financial statements and separate fund.
Okay, operation. We still have another item on our agenda, and I know Senator Corrin wanted to make the motion, but would someone else like to move to include these policy items in our recommendation to the bonding committee?
I'll make that motion.
Senator Sharon moves that the five Minsku policy items as written be recommended to the bonding committee for inclusion in the bonding bill. Any questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you very much,
Thank
Mr.
You, Madam
Johnson.
Chair, members.
And Senator Cohen? And Dr. Sarah, and whoever else. We have heard this issue before about the bioscience research proposals. So this is a new funding mechanism, I believe, and the bill's being passed out. Good.
I'm sure where you.
You can proceed. I'm just looking for what's being passed out. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Madam Chair, as you indicated, this is not a new issue for this committee. This is the request by the university to allow for development of the biomedical facilities. This has been, let me just make a couple of quick comments. Because we have a presentation, I want to have Dr. Sarah
have the bulk of the time in front of the committee. This has been through, this is what, the third reworking of the issue. And would remind members that almost everybody, there are a couple of exceptions, but almost everybody on this committee has been supportive of this effort. This has passed off the Senate floor, I think, on a couple of occasions by votes well into the 50s. And there have been some concerns expressed, again, not by the state Senate in terms of the total membership, but there have been some concerns expressed by others in the process relative to how this would dovetail with the state's bonding capacity and the ability to look at future bonding. So the university has spent time during the interim period reworking the issue to meet the objections of some of the people who've been involved in this process. And I recognize that theoretically we're not to talk about the other body, but my companion author of this legislation this year is Representative Hausman, who is somebody who has been central to some of the concerns. So the university, Dr. Sarah, Mr. Fitzenreiter, and others spent a lot of time with Representative Hausman and other members of the House to try to meet some of their concerns. So I think members are familiar with what the goal is, but maybe I could ask Dr. Sarah to offer some, I mean, obviously we've got a PowerPoint presentation, to remind members as to why we're doing this, and then maybe if it's Dr. Sarah, Mr. Fitzenreiter, we'll talk about the distinctions between this year's approach and last year's approach.
Dr. Sarah, welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you, Senator Cohn. First, I'd like to acknowledge Regent Hunter, who is sitting in the room, and Regent Johnson was here. I believe he had to step out for a minute. What this program is about is building a legacy for the state of Minnesota in the biosciences. Biosciences has been one of the major strengths of this university and has actually been very instrumental in building the biosciences community in the state of Minnesota that currently employs 250,000 Minnesotans. I'll get it right in a minute. I have the same thing you do, Madam Chair. I will do my best.
Just if you could just write me a prescription for some really strong suppressant.
I believe the future of the state is really at stake here in continuing to support this community and moving the new research out into that community to create new jobs and new businesses. What is the problem that we have today? The problem we have today is that our biosciences research is at capacity. It's at capacity because we don't have space to recruit faculty into. And if you don't have space to recruit faculty into in today's market, you can't recruit faculty and say, you're going to work here when you get here. It takes us 2 to 4 years to recruit faculty. We need stability and space to show them. And recently, recruits are between 2 to 3 years because we're really recruiting them away from Hopkins and Harvard and other places that faculty in today's market can go. And one of the things they look at is the facilities they do research in. This is not a productivity issue for us. We've measured our faculty productivity in the sense of federal grant dollars acquired per faculty member. And we're one of the highest in the nation. In fact, our School of Public Health is about the highest in the nation. So it's not a productivity issue for the faculty. And overall for the university, our research portfolio continues to grow at 8% a year in spite of the fact that federally sponsored research is flat, or if you adjust for the rate of inflation, is going down. We are able to compete. Our problem is our infrastructure, and that's all about the facilities. So let me share with you with what we have in mind, which is briefly summarized here, and I believe you have a larger version of that. We're asking now for funding for 4 buildings. You already funded 1 of the 5 we requested in the last session of the legislature, and we are on time and on budget for that facility. The first facility is the Center of Magnetic Resonance Research. This is hands down the world's best translational facility for imaging. particularly magnetic resonance imaging, and we need to really keep it that way if we're to get new diagnostics and therapeutics for Alzheimer's disease, neurobehavior, psychiatric disorders, and cancer. Speaking of cancer, the second building is the Cancer Biomedical Research Building, where our NCI Comprehensive Cancer Center, one of 40 in the United States, will be housed to really look at how do we identify, prevent, and cure cancer. So this first building I spoke of was about $53 million and will house 10 principal investigators. The second one is about $85 million. We will move in 2012 and has 40 new principal investigators. Each of these figures is adjusted to the midpoint is inflation adjusted to the midpoint of construction. I'll get that out in a minute. The third building houses the Lilly High Biomedical Research Group, and we, because of this building, we were able to do some really good recruiting, and this will fill up $86.1 million worth of space with 40 new PIs. The last new building we will move into in July 2013 is for infectious disease and neuroscience. Now, if I go to the next slide and you ask the question, what comes out the other end? Being an outcomes guy, I think it's important to know what are you actually going to produce with what you purchase. Well, this is kind of a list, and some of these are soft, some of them are pretty firm. New cures, new prevention, we have a long track record of that. We're now partnered with the Mayo Clinic and doing more of that, and I think we have a good track record for that. New technology commercialization is something else that will happen. There are already new startup companies, and I think with what Vice President Mulcahy has done to streamline our interface with industry, you will just begin to see more and more of this. We would predict, in a conservative way, 4,800 new jobs directly related to this project, and we already know we're attracting new venture capital into the state of Minnesota. There are a number of venture companies moving in here specifically because of this project, and they are already buying land up around here and the rest of the state as a place to put incubators and accelerators and new startup companies. I think most importantly, we will retain Minnesota's position as a world leader in biotechnology. And with that, I'll ask Mr. Fitzenreuter to review the finances for you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Cohen.
Could I just add one supplement to Dr. Sarah's comments, and that is that I want to emphasize the 4,800 new jobs. When we get the forecast on Thursday, I have no doubt that Dr. Stinson is going to reemphasize the fact that for the first time in certainly post-World War II economic history, Minnesota has now fallen behind the national mean in terms of job creation. And what you'll hear from the economists, there'll be a lot of talk during the session about how we're creating jobs, the bill yesterday, the bonding bill, and so on. I think what the state's economists, not simply Dr. Stinson, but economists plural, will suggest that a lot of the efforts we make here at the legislature are simply a recirculation within the state's economy. What they will tell you is that this is the effort that will make a difference to the state's economy, not simply, as Dr. Sarah points out, the direct creation of 4,800 jobs, but then the domino effect of hopefully the creation from the biomedical facilities of new manufacturing outlets. Obviously, the most very notable example is the establishment of Medtronic. I'm not going to go over all that again as I have a couple of years in front of this committee, but I do want to make that point that when we listen to Dr. Stinson on Thursday morning, I would assume he will talk about the lack of Minnesota's job growth. He'll emphasize this is what the state's economists, the Council of Economic Advisors, looks to as being the primary ability of Minnesota to find a new niche, more than a niche, but a new avenue for significant job creation.
Thank you. Mr. Futzenreiter.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, I'm Richard Fitzenreiter, the Chief Financial Officer and Treasurer at the University of Minnesota. The new version of this program, our hopefully not our third strike here, but the change in this program, what it is, what the legislation proposes is to create a a state program, a biomedical facilities funding program, that would finance four new research buildings. The university, in this proposal, is responsible for issuing the bonds for the total cost of the projects. I want to say that again. The university, in the name of the Board of Regents, will issue these bonds. These bonds are not issued by the state of Minnesota. That said, the legislation does create an 80-20 partnership between the state and the university to retire those bonds. It does that by creating a statutory in-law appropriation schedule that provides for the appropriation to pay a maximum of towards debt service, principal and interest payments, towards the $233.6 million of the state share of this $292 million investment program in these four facilities. The legislation has a schedule, which I think is the next slide that you don't have, but I wanted to share with you. Like any capital project, the issuance of this $292 million worth of debt, what this represents is the appropriation in the bill that phases in as we issue every series of bonds that the board issues. So, for example, in fiscal 10, this is really, as you can see, a tail issue, that in fiscal 10, the maximum appropriation from the general fund to the university would be $1 million. It then ramps up to $4 million. Ultimately, the legislation caps the state appropriation at $16.575 million, which would hit in roughly fiscal 2015. Do you have the slide on where we would build these buildings handy? I'd like to just also highlight for you that our plan, when we originally developed the stadium proposal and began to focus on where we would build the new TCF Bank Stadium, we looked at that large parking lot and knew that inevitably it would be a good idea for us to put the infrastructure in order for the university to build these buildings. Now, we knew that it was still not authorized by the legislature, but we put the roads in, the infrastructure in, the water systems in, the electrical systems in order to populate this particular area, this gateway district, with these biomedical facilities. That work is just ending, and we are ready to begin putting these buildings in, and it's why we feel we can, if this legislation is passed, get these buildings online in a very quick and cost-efficient manner. I would like to, if the committee would indulge me, to talk a little bit about the letter that was received from the Commissioner of Finance. I think people have been given a copy of that. This proposal that was the proposal for financing these four buildings was an idea that was advanced in discussions with members of the House of Representatives. I know we're not supposed to talk about them over here, but they approached us about a month ago to rethink how we might construct these buildings. And they asked us to think about whether the university couldn't, similar to how the stadium was constructed, issue this debt and that the state would provide us an appropriation. To be candid, I was a little nervous about that and talked to the rating agencies. And as you would expect, we have debt capacity issues as well. At the end of the day, we felt that this was a proposal that we could work with. And as a result, we endorsed the ideas that the House had proposed. Now, I want to make sure that the committee understands that the minute that this idea came to the university, I began discussions with Jane Rankin in the finance department to assure the finance department that they knew that this concept was being advanced in a manner similar to the stadium. Last Friday, I finally had a meeting with members of the finance department to go over the details. Frankly, the university, and I'll grouse a little bit about it, was unaware until just before this committee hearing that the state had made a decision to begin to count this annual appropriation within the 3% debt guidelines. Frankly, that was news to us. They didn't intimate that to me on Friday when we met with them. I think they're wrong-headed on that. I will tell you that this proposal, as I said earlier, this debt will be issued in the name of the Board of Regents of the University of Minnesota. Now, the university, and I want to be clear, has never denied that the issuance of this debt by the university does have, and I want to be clear with you, does have credit implications for the state of Minnesota. This debt is issued in the name of the Board of Regents, but the rating agencies consider it really straddling a fence of an obligation of the university, but also an obligation of the state of Minnesota. It really straddles the fence. The stadium proposal straddled the fence, where it's a limited obligation. It's even written up in the rating agency document, a limited obligation of the University of Minnesota, but also has credit implications for the state. I will tell you that if the university never failed to make a payment on that debt, on either this debt or the stadium, we're going to take a hit on our credit rating. If the state didn't make that payment to the university to pay the stadium debt or this debt, the rating agencies are going to look not well on the credit rating of the state. It straddles both of us, and it has implications for both of us. But I would argue that it does not fall within the 3% debt guideline. Every debt that the state has issued under that 3% debt guideline has been general obligation debt of the state, full faith and credit and taxing powers of the state. There are five debt guidelines of the state, and one of those guidelines, this debt does fall under. I don't believe it falls under the 3%, but it does fall under the fourth guideline, and I'll read it to you. The total amount of state general obligation debt, moral obligation debt, state bond guarantees, equipment capital leases, and real estate leases are not to exceed 5% of state personal income. This debt issued by the University of Minnesota, you do, I want to be clear, in my judgment, you do have a moral obligation to make that payment to the university, or the rating agencies will look poorly on the state. But I do not feel that it falls within the 3% guideline. It is within another guideline, and the university has never denied that. The finance department has a different opinion. They now call it the 3% guideline and played that in. I have a different opinion. You're going to have to sort it out. To be honest, our interest is in seeing these buildings built as quickly as possible. We assumed it didn't apply. We still assume that it shouldn't apply, but you'll have to make a judgment. And with that, I'll stand for questions. And I did that quickly. I hope it wasn't too confusing. Debt and credit implications are very complicated matters.
Are there any questions from members of the committee or interest in having Mr. Roloffs come back? Senator Michelle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I was going to try to connect with the author, Cohen. I liked the first version of this bill 2 years ago. I liked the bill last year. This bill looks good, too. Does the chair of the Finance Committee have any immediate reactions to this communication from the Finance Department?
Senator Cohen.
Well, I'm sure, Senator Michelle, I've had the chance to talk to the university representatives about the communication, I just saw it right before the committee hearing began, so I haven't had a chance to talk to Commissioner Hansen or anybody else. But certainly the university has offered the distinction relative to this proposal and the 3%. I'm comfortable with that. I arguably was, and Sarah Michelle, obviously you've been heavily involved with university issues and had more involvement than myself with the stadium proposal. I was more uncomfortable with that than I am with this proposal, because I think this has, and that's not to denigrate the stadium proposal, but in terms of the ability to financially back up what's going on, there's potentially, I would argue, more downside with the stadium. I mean, if you have a football team like you had last year, do you have the ability to fill the stadium? Whereas this, in terms of the economics, is has more of a certainty. So I'm actually more comfortable with this than I'm with the stadium proposal, and I'm comfortable with what Mr. Fitzenreiter just presented. But again, I haven't had a chance to talk to people from finance.
Madam Chair, and that's fair.
Senator Michelle.
I didn't mean to put you on the spot, Senator Cohen. I want to see this legislation passed. And maybe Mr. Roloffs, if you could just take this back, because I'm not sure you're in a position to answer many more details. But, Madam Chair, I'm just not a fan of letters this time of year. A letter to the legislature or, frankly, a letter to the governor this time of year usually means people aren't talking. It usually means that some lines of communication haven't been used or established, and it doesn't always help. So I'm going to encourage, and I will play whatever constructive role I can between the administration and the Senate and the rest of the legislature to get people talking again, Madam Chair and Senator Cohen. And I guess I want to encourage more talk and less letters.
Well, and Madam
Senator Cohen.
Chair, Senator Michelle, that certainly is appreciated, and I can't speak for the university, but I'm sure they would second that. You know, the frustration with this issue, and Senator Michelle, you've been more than helpful in regard to this particular issue over these last couple of years. The frustration is that the university presents a proposal. Okay, then we rework it to meet objections. Then we rework it to meet objections. And it just kind of continues on to infinity. There was and the Senate disagreed with it. There was opposition from the House of Representatives. So the university comes up with a proposal that they think parallels the stadium proposal, and all of a sudden there's something else. And I'm not sure I don't want to go through the letter from Commissioner Hansen, but keep in mind, and certainly I want to talk to him as well as to other people in finance, but it says, the commissioner says, a multidisciplinary bioscience campus, et cetera, offers great potential to attract science faculty, become a high-wage job engine for the region. I support the university's forward-thinking proposal and will work with you to incorporate our concerns into the final legislation. I think some of what is in this letter I'd like to think can be easily accommodated. And to the extent that you can help with that, we'll certainly take advantage of that.
Senator Cohen, our staff has found a typo on 114. The sections are incorrect. So maybe you want to move to strike 137, let's say point 51 to 137.60. And insert 137.61 to 137.64. Those are the proper sections of the statute.
And so would so move, Madam Chair.
Senator Cohen makes that motion. Is there any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know that there are some fine distinctions that have to be decided here, but in the end, the state will be responsible for 80% of these bonds. Is that correct? The bond payments will be responsible for 80%. But what I am a little more concerned about is something that's been happening on the horizon. I happen to have a brother who is a cancer researcher at the University of Iowa and depends greatly on NIH grants to run his lab. And in the process of doing that, he also has to become an evaluator for other NIH grants. And he was just in Washington 2 weeks ago doing some of those evaluations. And he indicated that it was a very, very difficult job because the amount of money for those grants is getting so reduced that they were able to only fund 1 in 10 grant requests. And in the past, it has been much better than that. And we may build these buildings, but will we get the grants to operate them? And if we don't get the grants, what is the fallback position? What revenue do we have to operate them?
Dr. Sarah.
Madam Chair, Senator, I think this is a great question. I'm going to give you several levels of answers because I've thought about this question myself quite a bit. Number one, we have funding in-house to hire the faculty for the CMRR and most of the cancer building already, period. So that's just worth knowing. Number two, I can only answer by track record. Number one is a fact I gave you. Our portfolio, including the NIH, but our federally sponsored portfolio, which is all national competitive peer-reviewed, growing at 7 to 8% per year, period. Where does that money come from? Well, there's no more money going in there, so we're competing with other institutions and literally taking it from them. That's absolute true. It's marketplace competition in a national peer-reviewed competitive system. In the areas the university has invested resources, some from the state, some of its own, which are the designated areas of growth, all of which you see in these buildings, our research portfolio of federally sponsored funds is growing at 40 to 45% per year. We can get the faculty. We don't have trouble recruiting. 90-plus percent of the time, we're able to land the faculty we recruit. So based on track record, we can get there. The problem we have now is if we don't have a facility to show them, they're not going to come here. And then you lose that market edge in the community. So I need to answer the last part of your question this way. These buildings are not just to support the health sciences. One might assume that because of the names, and perhaps I haven't done a good enough job explaining who's actually in these. The university promotes interdisciplinary, interprofessional research. So when I say a building is focusing on magnetic resonance imaging, that's a true statement. But what's in there with health sciences faculty are faculty from mathematics, physics, the cognitive neuroscience people in the College of Liberal Arts, psychology in the College of Liberal Arts, psychiatry, and so on, to say nothing of the engineers. When I say we're looking at cancer research, you can't do today's translational research without mechanical engineers, without biomaterial engineers, without mathematicians, without computational biologists, and so on and so forth. So that filling these buildings is a Twin Cities campus-wide effort. It isn't just health sciences. And given what we recruit in a year, filling these buildings is simply not going to be a challenge for us.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Cohn and panel. First, I want to commend Senator Cohn and your co-authors for bringing this forward. And I don't mind saying that I share some frustration here, however, because in part this discussion reminds me about earlier discussions we had about the University of Minnesota Mayo Clinic Genomics Partnership. And frankly, very simply, this is ours to lose. Because while we can go back and forth with a series of communications or letters or bills or drafts or proposals, other states are moving forward. And as they move forward, we lose. And when we have discussions in the tax committee, in economic development, and globally about jobs and growing this economy, this is an excellent example of an economic tool, I would argue, not only for the Twin Cities area, but in fact for all of Minnesota.
Thank you. I think there's another committee that needs to come in here, so I think we need to move on. Senator Cohn, did you want to move to include Senate File 3094 and the division's recommendation to the bonding committee?
Madam Chair, I would so move, and as you know, I would also like to have this report out separately. So I don't know if you want to do that now to the full Finance Committee or at some further committee hearing.
I think we can do that, right? Report it out to the full Finance Committee. Right. Okay. Why don't you just make two separate motions?
Yes. So Madam Chair, I would move that Senate File. 3094. Be included in the recommendations on the part of the Higher Education Division to the Capital Investment Committee for inclusion in the Capital Investment Bill.
Is there any discussion on that motion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
And then, Madam Chair, I'd move that Senate File 3094 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the full Finance Committee.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. Motion prevails.
Chair members, thank you.
Thank you. Members, the letter that we need to transmit to Senator Langseth is before you, and I'm recommending that the committee recommends all the projects on the MNSCU request list and the University of Minnesota request list plus HEPRA, and the language that we already adopted for MNSCU and the recommendation that we already adopted on 3094, and that the